Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. We're into an extremely tough time in our past, 1851, and about to hear about the struggle for control of an area of the Amatolas that the Boers had named Waterkloof, better known by local Amatosa as Mtontsi. It's a case of jungle warfare, as you're going to hear. The area of operations was only 40 square kilometres in size, and yet it remained out of Britain's control for most of the Eighth Frontier War. If you have an old steam-driven hard copy map of the area, or you can fire up your trusty digital device of choice, go to Google Maps and focus on the area between the Kat and Kunup rivers, to the west of the town of Kwamakoma, which used to be known as Fort Beaufort. Just to add a bit of postmodern spice here, nearby Cookhouse Wind Farm is one of the largest in South Africa, on the high ridge east of the Great Fish River, near this Waterkloof. The Waterkloof itself is a deep, narrow valley, 6 kilometres long, bounded by the Kroom Heights to the south, and to the north by a second series of majestic ridges which fall away to a rolling plateau. Running roughly southeast and open at its western side, it comes to a head in a high, grassy tableland fringed with bushes and gigantic trees. To the east, this tableland falls away into another deep, heavily forested gorge, known as Fuller's Hook. It was in this gorge, in a gigantic overhanging cave of a type that proliferates in this area, that Amangrika chief Makoma had his headquarters during the war. The plateau is linked to the Kroom by a narrow ridge, and where this joins the plateau is a horseshoe-shaped flat area, approximately a square kilometre in size, and fringed by towering forests. In due course, this part of the world would be called Mount Misery by the British troops who fought around it. In the mountain fastnesses above, there are two reserves today, Mpofu and Fort Fordyce. Here you'll still find the Chakma baboon and black wildebeest on the escarpment, blue dacre, mountain reedbuck. If you're lucky, you'll spot the Cape parrot and eagles while the playful Nizna luris abound. The caracal is the largest predator these days, but in the past leopards would stalk here, eating a snack of rock dussy. The vegetation on these southern-facing slopes approaches jungle thickness, surpassing even the depths of the Kaiskamma River ravines, although virtually all these immense trees I've mentioned have disappeared. In 1851, the slopes were full of timber species like ironwood and real yellowwood. Unfortunately, not many of these extraordinary trees are left. The real yellowwood, for example, could grow to 40 metres in height, over 130 feet. Ironwoods up to 35 metres. But there's enough of Fort Fordyce Nature Reserve to experience what I'm going to describe this episode. The forest's silence was going to be shattered by repeated attempts by the British to dislodge Chief Makoma from his mountain fastness. If you travel to Fort Fordyce Park today, you'll find remarkable rock climbing opportunities with enigmatic names like Sunset Crag, Orange Wall, Miscreant, and some are regarded as extremely challenging, even for experienced climbers. The entire area is a mosaic of grassland, forest valleys and thickets, with a vast range of indigenous fauna and flora. At the top, the escarpment, it's characterized by montane vegetation, constantly exposed to the sun, it's grassland. The shaded valleys and slopes near the rivers and streams support the forest, which is a virtual jungle. Just to formalize this landscape description, the dominant vegetation types along these ridges, valleys and escarpments are known as the Amatola montane grassland, the southern mist belt forest, and eastern Cape escarpment thicket. The grasslands support bluegrass, wiregrass, and rooi gras, vital for cattle grazing. As the sand at Xhosa knew, many of the plants are edible. For example, the flower of an hour, a hibiscus. The leaves, the roots, and stems of the young plant can be eaten raw or cooked. The indigenous people also use the ground shoots of the hibiscus as an infusion to treat wounds and as a painkiller. Its other uses are as a laxative and for stomach aches as well as skin problems and rashes. Perhaps after the next few months of warfare on these slopes, both sides would have appreciated bits of fountain bush, which can be found across southern Africa near rivers and flades or wetlands. People here have used the plant for hundreds of years as an emetic and to treat psychological stress. And boy, was there going to be a lot of that. To explain further by way of a modern description, The Fort Fordyce Mountain Hike is rated 10 out of 10 in difficulty, the highest rating in Southern Africa. This extraordinary bit of geography was going to plague the British for all their mastery of the seas and so forth. Mountain-jungle conflict is a unique matter. The experience at Waterkloof, aka Umtonzi, in 1851 was still being analysed by British military experts in the 1940s during the Second World War. What they learned in the Amatolas was going to be incorporated into jungle and non-conventional warfare training for the next century. Just to complete the circle of connection, many of the British officers and troops who survived the coming clashes in the Amatolas and the Waterkloof Ridges were going to end up in the Crimean War, which would begin virtually as the Eighth Frontier War ended. There's another connection. Thomas Baines was the official war artist for the British of this campaign. He was destined to achieve worldwide fame posthumously, but at the time considered to be no more than a competent journeyman artist. He was selling his now famous prints for a few shillings. They're worth hundreds of thousands of US dollars today, and I'll share some of his battle paintings and sketches from the Waterkloof on my blog. Another interesting note, Baines sketched and painted so close to the action on the Amatola Ridges, he was often in danger of being a casualty himself, a kind of early form of war photographer, except he was holding a sketchbook, not a Canon or Nikon. With that introduction, let's dive in. Fort Armstrong had fallen to Makoma's men at the end of January 1851, but the other forts along the Tumi Valley and deep in the Amatola Mountains had survived, albeit by the skin of their teeth. It was with some relief for the colony that they would see the arrival of the Royal Mail steamer Bosphorus in Cape Town, a relatively quick passage from Plymouth to the Cape in only 43 days. A month later, in February, a P&O steamer called Singapore brought troops and gold to the Cape in a record 37 days. The British logistics channels were improving. The iron paddle steamer called Birkenhead was also being fitted out in Southampton, designed as a warship but delivered as a troop ship. The Birkenhead would go on to become almost mythological. It was so important in maritime history, sinking near Hans Bay, just south of Hermanus, and lead to the well-known phrase, "Women and children first." But let's not jump the gun here, back to the Eighth Frontier War. It was a day after the Amakosa attacked Fort Hare in January 1851 that a Khoikhoi led a force of 400 men to Fort Armstrong on the slopes of the Amatolas. His men were armed with muskets and they were all riding horses, a significant force for the time. Willem Eithalder was his name. I mentioned him in previous episodes. He'd been trained as a member of the Cape Mounted Rifles and had retired to the Cut River settlement. After being on the receiving end of the Grahamstown elite who wanted his land, he joined Macomb's war. James Reed, the missionary at Fort Armstrong, rode out to meet Eithalder to parley. Eithalder pointed out that Reed was young when he'd arrived at the Cut River, and yet the oppressions won't cease. His land was in danger, and the Khoi were fighting alongside the Amakosa to claim back their land. But Eithalder offered the 33 Englishmen hiding inside the fort a way out. They could leave. What is hard for us to understand these days is that these 33 were asked to leave their wives and children behind, trusting the missionaries and the Khoikhoi to protect them. If the 33 Englishmen left, their women and children would be safe, watched by the missionaries who'd also stay behind. It was agreed. Chillingly, word reached the fort overnight, though, that a settler commando had overrun a rebel camp near the Cut River, killing most of the people there, men, women, and children. Suddenly, Reed wrote, they seemed to ooze the premonitions of a war of the races. Eithalder seemed to vacillate. Should he seek revenge for this rebel camp overrun and kill all the Englishmen, the women, and the children? In this moment of tension and fear, Reed took the initiative, jumped onto his horse, and led the 33 Englishmen away. Incredibly, they left their women and children behind to be protected by the other missionaries. As the white men galloped out of the fort, the Khoikhoi woman shouted, "Shoot them! Cut their throats!" But no one touched the children nor the women. An honor code, thousands of years old, unbroken still. What a bizarre reality history is. And for anyone who doesn't think this is true, check the facts. You'll be amazed. The flight of these 33 Englishmen, led by one of the missionaries, was the signal for breakdown of all authority at Fort Armstrong. The settlers' homes were ransacked, while the women and children hid, along with the missionaries, at the Reeds' home village of Phillipton. Fort Armstrong became the only one on the frontier to fall into rebel hands. Moving along. By February 1851, the bitterness of the Eighth Frontier War was becoming more evident, with descriptions of British troops being captured and tortured to death by the Amakosa. Settlers were now marching through the Toomey Valley in revenge, burning everything and carrying a flag which had the word extermination emblazoned for all to see. Governor Sir Harry Smith had advocated extermination of the Amakosa and the Khoi Khoi in letters and conversations because he was panicking, besieged in King Williamstown, and chaos was the order of the day. The governor was lashing out. No quarter was being given by either side, man against man. Some reasonable voices did resonate, lonely voices, warning that the bloodlust on both sides was unsustainable. Who was to blame for turning this region into a race-baited, venomous sea of murder and carnage? And what was the end game? No one would prosper from such seething lunacy. It was too soon for full-scale recrimination, but many of the neutral observers and even government officials began pointing their accusatory fingers at Sir Harry Smith. The governor's regulations about replacing Xhosa chiefs had triggered this war, and Smith was unable to mount any offensive to defend his own forts. And yet, the Amakosa offensive against the numerous forts had failed, and they began to fall onto the defensive. Bit of a standoff. British reinforcements arrived to support Smith and his forces, along with 1,500 Khoi Khoi levies, the workers. They landed in East London after being conscripted in the Cape. They marched to King Williamstown, the first of many more who were going to march along this road. By September 1851, the British were ready to try and take the deep Waterkloof forests and ravines, or so they thought. The Amakosa and the Khoi Khoi were armed with muskets, and furthermore, they now had a comprehensive understanding of how the British army operated. Adding to the pain, the Khoi Khoi marksmen had also rebelled, and in the coming clashes in the Waterkloof, they were going to be crucial. To the north of the Amatola Mountains, the Amamtembu had rebelled, turning this war from a threat to a possible catastrophe. One thing was very different from previous wars. The Amakosa had initially focused their attention only on the forts, not the farms. Then, after being rebuffed by the defenders at Fort Hare and Fort Cox, Makoma switched tactics. He turned his attention to the homesteads and began picking these off at will, destroying farm after farm. In the face of such systematic planning, Smith was told he should ask the Boers to come and help. As you know, he had alienated the Boers, and in particular, their highly skilled diplomat and organizer, André Stockenstrom, the aging leader who lived under the Amatola Mountains himself, who was known for his amazing library. Stockenstrom was a thinking person. Smith and Stockenstrom were bitter enemies. Furthermore, the old Boer leader was ill, and anyway, he was far more interested at this point in leaving for London to join John Fairbairn to press their joint case for a South African constitution and franchise, an elected upper house, to govern the colony instead of being governed by the British. Smith's war was his own problem. Smith could not swallow his pride. You know what they say, pride before the fall, and in Smith's case, a pertinent comment. Instead of pursuing Stockenstrom for help, Smith turned to Colonel Henry Somerset, who was now openly regarded with contemptuousness in the settler press. "Retreating further and further from the enemy has made them more daring," fumed a letter writer in the Grahamstown Journal. Somerset was stung into action. On the 7th of September, he sent a large patrol into the Waterkloof, 600 men from the 74th Highland Regiment under Lieutenant Colonel Thomas Fordyce, the man who gave his name to the reserve. And he was also going to give his life to the mountains. Like many other British officers before him, he completely and utterly miscalculated the complexities of fighting inside these Eastern Cape thickets, these ravines, these mountains. His actions over the next few weeks are legendary, mostly for the wrong reasons. When Fordyce entered the Waterkloof, he said it was an overnight patrol. Somerset, to be fair, was not fully appraised of the harebrained scheme, while Cape Mounted Rifles Cavalry Colonel William Sutton tried to stop Fordyce from going in. It didn't work. His 600 men had only 2,000 rounds of ammunition between them. There were at least 4,000 Amakosa warriors on the heights, most armed with muskets. Yes, these weapons were older and perhaps less accurate, but when you have such massive firepower advantage, that doesn't matter. As long as the men wielding the advantage were willing to hurl themselves into the battle continuously, and they were. Fordas's 600 made their way up the Kroom Valley inside the Waterkloof, using a woodcutter's path. It was a dark march during the day. I've spent time describing the type of vegetation for a good reason. Imagine making your way up this tiny path, dominated by some of the tallest tree species in the world, long-stemmed giants, yellowwood, ironwood, assegai wood, the canopies shutting out the light, dim below, ferns and moist tangles of creepers, monkey ropes throttling the bush, dripping with moisture. It was a beautiful march, and sinister. As they emerged from the high ground, the montane grasses, hundreds of Amaxhosa warriors appeared, whistling, shouting. The skirmish began in what could be called slow motion. The Highlanders fixed bayonets and charged. The Amaxhosa withdrew, then regrouped. After half an hour, most of the English ammunition was expended. Sutton of the Cape Mounted Rifles then told Fordas it was time to go. "No," said Fordas. "They should remain on the escarpment all night, harassing the Amaxhosa." Sutton managed to convince Fordas to retire, reminding him of the shortage of ammunition. The British contingents, led by the 74th Highland Regiment, turned to a second path for the descent, a much steeper path. At first things went well, the men and the horses trundling down the cliffs as the afternoon sun glowed. Below, in the dark thickets, sounds could be heard. Then one sound dominated, the unique sound of a booming gong. A gong, perhaps a rock that was being struck, but for the British, it was undeniably the sound of a gong. As the men of the 74th Highlanders turned towards this strange noise, their blood ran cold because Amaxhosa Chief Macoma galloped from the bush, riding a horse, grey, white in colour, and dressed in settler's clothes. It was a moment of disbelief, perhaps disconnection. Macoma rode to within musket range in full view of the Highlanders, turned to his army somewhere behind him, and directed them to cut off the British descent. The steep path downwards was challenging, even for the best riders, blocked by trees which the Amaxhosa had felled. The tactics were designed to break up the Highlanders by sections, making them easier to attack. It's what the German tribes did to the Roman columns in the forests of Europe. Fordas's column shattered in the near dark. Then the Amamfengu rearguard bolted, and a shock shuddered down the line. Hand-to-hand fighting erupted along the length of this column, the Amaxhosa warriors hissing through their teeth, smoke from the muskets blinding both sides. It was part wrestling, part knife fighting, part point-blank shooting. This was the start of the battle for the Waterkloof, a tiny spot on the massive southern African landscape, and yet focused in its violence and malevolence. A kind of symbolic place, bayonets, assegais, muskets, hands on the throats. An hour of malevolence unfolded in desperation, then it ended. Eventually, the column cleared the forest, leaving 14 British soldiers dead within, the same number wounded. Dozens of Amaxhosa were also casualties. When the Highlanders staggered back to base, they counted their cartridges. 20 were left. It was apparent to all that had Fordas forced them to stay on the montane heights above Waterkloof, none would have made it out. Sutton was right to question his commander's bloodlust. Folks, this clash in the African bush appears somewhat irrelevant. Beware the eyes of the Amatolas. It is remarkable that in these days of our knowledge of history, this incredible combat between the British and the Amaxhosa has been hidden away, buried beneath a number, the Eighth Frontier War. It was much more than that. A month after this dishevelled British patrol, Harry Smith pulled together a much bigger force, 1,150 men, almost twice the size of Fordas's patrol, split into two columns. Lieutenant Colonel Fordas led one out of Fort Beaufort on the 12th of October towards the Waterkloof and the Kroom Ravine. Colonel Henry Somerset joined him along with Colonel Michel in the second force, and they once again assaulted the moist depths and chaotic ravines of this challenging landscape. The 91st, the 74th Highlanders, the 12th, the 2nd Queens, and an Amamfengu Warrior Regiment were joined by the Cape Mounted Rifles, along with some civilian irregulars, a significant army heading towards Macoma and Chief Sandile. Their warriors were now 6,000 in all and were ready. Mount Misery soon earned its name. As Noel Mostad explains in his book Frontiers, the British troops faced some of the strangest pockets of eccentric weather they'd ever experienced. During the day, the sun was so hot their musket barrels sizzled, while the forest's shade was more like a jungle. It was humid, close, sweaty. The nights bitterly cold, damp, fog and rain. The wind swept piercingly cold over our lofty resting place. The men threw up little walls of loose stones and rock, piling earth round them and large slabs of stone over, said one officer. They awoke regularly to white frost. Both officers and men would stand around fires, stamping their feet and thawing their hands. The Amakhosa warriors were close enough to yell insults. One in particular was repeated regularly. "Hello, you tortoises! Why do you keep us here in the cold?" The 74th Regiment uniforms resembled checkered tortoise shells. When the warriors spotted British officers reading maps, a sniper would be called out, the koi koi crack shot. And by the end of this campaign, so many British officers had been shot that Queen Victoria was to express her shock and concern. As the regiments marched around the Waterkloof, some soldiers would be plucked from the trail, grabbed and dragged away. The technique used by the ambushers included a hail of assegais from point-blank range and then a sniper would fire from a high position somewhere in the trees. But it wasn't all plain sailing for Makoma and his men. The average British soldier responded with courage and learned quickly how to fight in the thick Cape bush. They had also heard about Thomas Stubbs' quiet soldiering tactics and began to lay up themselves, waiting along trails to waylay Amakhosa sections. The most beautiful and exotic places are often the most dangerous for soldiers, so too these splendid slopes. 18-hour marches inside the dark forest cause hallucinations of exhaustion. The soldiers had to face detached rocks which tumbled, wild vines that twisted along the trails, tripping up the unwary, endless monkey ropes that had to be chopped away, dense thorny underwood where hooked thorns clung to arms and legs, slashing uniforms and tearing flesh. The very geography was the enemy, and the Amakhosa were masters of this bush. The Amamfenga, though, were masters too, and so, by now, were the settler militia, who could move as stealthily as any warrior, reading the landscape as well. By November, there were hundreds of casualties on both sides, and the British cannon had been really effective. The stench of death hung over the forest, as most of the Amakhosa dead could not be carried away, and lay amongst the vines, the bright flowers, slowly disappearing into the Amatola mulch. Finally, a word about the mental side of this battle. The Khoi Khoi and many of the Amakhosa would often sing hymns before battle, joined by their women and children hiding somewhere in the thickets. The hymns were fervently rendered. God was invoked in the fight against the soldiers. This was an astonishing experience for the British. One soldier wrote later that on a Sunday in the Waterkloof he heard, "From the depths below arose in a childlike strain the glorious morning hymn, Awake my soul, and with the sun thy daily course of duty run." Except the childlike strains were being sung by men who were about to try and cut the British throats. Harry Smith was not impressed. "The devil can quote scripture when it suits his purpose." It was the Khoi Khoi and Amakhosa who said the same thing about the British hymns and scripture quoting. Next episode, we'll wrap up the special look at the crucial series of ravines and mountains and then move into 1852. I'll also round up what else was going on across Southern Africa. Please rate the podcast on your favourite platform. It helps elevate the visibility. You can head off to desmondlatham.blog where I'll load an update about the episodes. You can also register for my little newsletter. Until next, salagatli.